This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest, David Conrad. What a fascinating career in the world of capital raising and private equity, from Guggenheim Partners to Focus Point Capital. He really has seen just a little bit of everything and is very, very knowledgeable about how that side of the investment world works. If you're at all interested in a variety of diversified and non-correlated strategies, what it's like raising capital for both emerging and existing managers, and playing in the world of credit, leasebacks, music industry, royalty funding, as well as traditional private equity, you're going to find this to be absolutely fascinating. With no further ado, my conversation with Focus Point Private Capital Group's David Conrad.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My special guest this week is David Conrad. He is the co-founder and CEO at Focus Point Private Capital Group and Landsea Investments. He played a key role in sourcing six separate Guggenheim-sponsored strategies. Collectively, those raised over $6 billion of limited partner money. He also helped to establish the Guggenheim Private Fund Group with more than $7 billion in fund allocations. David Conrad, welcome to Bloomberg.
Barry, thank you. Glad to be here.
So let's start in the middle. You've been working in the asset management industry for a long time, but let's start with your role at Guggenheim Partners. You were there when the firm was formed in 2000. Tell us about your role and what you did for them.
Sure. I left HSBC Group at the end of 1999, and some friends of mine that I'd known a long time had came out of the fixed income side at a number of investment banks, generally top II-rated mortgage research and more traders, fixed income salesmen, and to raise third-party capital, a broker-dealer is required. So I established a little fundraiser group at this small broker-dealer, and with the knowledge that we were going to try to create a financial brand out of a museum name. Mm-hmm. And one of the founders of the broker-dealer was very close to the Guggenheim family, the father and the son, that were owners of this brand. And we spent a little bit of time during 2000, and in October 2000, we merged the broker-dealer with the Guggenheim brothers, created Guggenheim Partners, and then also in the same month closed on, I believe it was $28 million in working capital. And then we had a reverse merger also in the same month with a commercial paper conduit in Chicago by the name of Liberty Hampshire. Mm-hmm. And the CEO and founder of Liberty Hampshire, Mark Walter, is still Guggenheim's CEO today.
That's quite interesting. How did being at Guggenheim, when it was founded, affect both your career and the way you think about private equity?
I was exposed to private equity when I was at HSBC Group after business school, and that's where I was exposed to it in the early 1990s when HSBC was on an acquisition binge in mm-hmm. the late 80s, early 90s, and acquired some asset management businesses in the U.S. And when I graduated business school, joined them, and I was generally calling on institutions raising long-only Southeast Asian equity mandates. Mm-hmm. And at that time, only the largest pension funds and institutional investors would make an allocation to such a narrow strategy. Mm-hmm. And so it got me, it allowed me to start a dialogue with some of the largest institutional investors in the United States marketing those products. And through that, I was introduced to an individual that owned 25% of a management company and HSBC owned 75% of, where he had two small $35 million private equity funds focused on Southeast Asia and China. Performance looked pretty interesting. And his goal in 1992, I believe, 93, was to try to raise some capital for the United States. And
Was that your entree into the world of private equity?
That was my entree into, and we went down to, I think it was Merrill Lynch, to talk to their fund placement. My boss was a CEO. There were six of us, and the CEO told the general partner, a guy named David Patterson, to take myself down there. And I saw the fees that were that Merrill Lynch would earn on raising a private equity fund versus the fees, I was getting raising the long only. And that was an easy decision from my standpoint. This looks really interesting. If I can raise, $250 million at a 2% fee, that looks
not
pretty interesting.
Shabby, right.
And, maybe I know some of the people that might take a look at this. And so that's how it started.
And you raised a little more than $250 million.
We raised, I think it was the largest Asian private equity fund ever. We closed it in, I think, December 22nd, 1994.
Uh-huh.
And we raised 250, and then we raised a fund in India in the mid-90s. HSBC sponsored a team to invest in India and South Asia. It's probably one of the earlier ones then.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a drive with an advisory board meeting from Agra to Jaipur. I think it took 8 hours. It'd be the equivalent of driving from New York to Hartford.
Right, it took 8 hours. So yeah. Not exactly a smoothly
it was,
paved road.
India's changed quite a bit from the mid-90s. And then we raised a successor fund for Asia after the Thai baht crisis in Indonesia. The rupiah went from, I think, 2,000 to 20,000 overnight. And then the U.S. firms came into Southeast Asia, and saw that as a big opportunity.
How did those funds do? Because when I think of Asia, I can't help but think of the peak in Japan in 89, and that's subsequently done poorly. I guess when you're doing private equity, you don't care about those mark-to-markets. You're working off a working business.
A lot of the funds that were fully invested by the time of the Thai baht crisis and the currency crisis in late 97, January 98, were really hurt. They were generally borrowing in U.S. dollars, and their revenues now were reduced by, 10 times.
Right.
And so it was tough. So once we raised the successor fund, all the U.S. private equity firms started to come into Asia, forming groups, all the big names. We started to hire teams to take advantage as they're trying to expand their footprint. And HSBC stayed in the lower mid-market. They raised another fund in 2002, 2003. I was at Guggenheim at that time, and they became a client. So it worked out well that not only the group in Asia that we raised capital for, but HSBC had a group in Latin America and also a group in Europe that spun out and has later rebranded themselves Montague. But we raised a little over $2.2 billion for Montague in early 2000s.
So you start Focus Point Private Capital in 2010. How was this different from what you've done previously in your career? And what services does Focus Point provide?
Yeah, so we learned a lot at HSBC. We had as a minority shareholder is an insurance company, and that seeded a number of the funds that we raised at Guggenheim. So in addition to using a broker-dealer at Guggenheim to raise third-party capital, Guggenheim was a principal in a number of different strategies. And we would identify the management team. The insurance company would provide some seed capital to get some investments completed, and then we would go out to the market and raise the initial fund. And then we would generally raise a follow-on fund two or fund three, and a number of credit-related strategies as well as some equity. Following the financial crisis in 08, Guggenheim, I would say, less interested in seeding new managers,
mm-hmm.
and more using the balance sheet that they were building to act more as a direct investor. Middle of 2010, a lot of us on the capital raising the private fund group inside Guggenheim became independent. We're still very close with a number of the people that were there when we were there.
Mm-hmm.
And Focus Point raises capital for private funds and direct transactions. And I would say it's similar to what we were doing at Guggenheim in that we were continually meeting with investors and general partners. One dynamic I'm noticing is increasingly the capital raising business, we're acting like, almost like a search firm, because we're continually meeting investment talent, whether it's talented investors inside a private equity firm, other independent sponsors that are more comfortable or confident in their ability to find profitable transactions, and I've been unable to convince them to do a fund, or talented limited partners that have been, you know, investing in the asset class for a number of years. Huh. And we continue to see it evolve. But, you know, looking back, you know, we've probably raised capital for over 20 first-time funds, and which requires a lot of work. But the reason you do it is for the successor funds.
So let's talk about that, because I tend to think in terms of venture capital, doing a seed round and then a follow-up A round or a B round or a C round. When you talk about successor funds, are you going back to the same funds you seeded, or is it different projects, different investments?
I'll give you an example at Guggenheim, for example. So we, following early 2000s, after 9/11, air traffic was way off. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the airlines went from wide body to narrow body. You notice that when you fly cross country now, it's a single aisle, not a double aisle.
Right.
And we were introduced to a group that spun out of British Aerospace, and they had been buying commercial aircraft on their own account and engines that power them. And they were backed by a big high net worth family on the West Coast that was the equity partner. It would be impossible to go to a bank to borrow money to buy a 747 without, you know, revealing who the source of your equity was. So they had to institutionalize their business. And so Guggenheim did that. And by committing some initial capital, we went out and the team went out and got some investments completed. And it was as the load factors were off, they were buying a lot of wide-body 747s and converting them into freighter to take advantage of the global supply chain moving from just-in-time delivery. So component parts and things like that coming out of Asia to the West wanted, you know, there is a demand for 747s. So the team recognized that opportunity and did it. And it's actually a big job to convert.
I would imagine.
You know, you have to cut a hole in this, drill a big hole in the side of the aircraft. It's got to be structurally sound,
right,
strengthen the floor. But we were pretty successful with that. Raised, six investments completed, proved out the thesis, and we raised $277 million for Fund One. And the successor fund, to get around to answering your question, is was 737. We got up to 741. We couldn't quite get to 747 in capital. And so we backed it down to 737.
That's funny.
And true story. And but
and now, what did the successor fund invest in?
They did more. The market had changed, and so they started doing some new aircraft. Mm-hmm. Boeing came out with a new 747-8, mm-hmm. and so they put in an order for some new ones. The existing Fund One, the entire portfolio was sold to a. Another private equity firm had a listed vehicle to do aircraft leasing, and they needed to grow, so they just bought the entire portfolio. So we had we generated a nice return in a very short period of time, proved out had a nice track record, which enabled us to raise Fund Two.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the asset managers you work with and help raise money through. Walk us through that process from due diligence to investing. What is that process like?
It's a lot of detail and it's a lot of work, but it's also, you know, having done it a lot, it's pattern recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've met thousands and thousands of general partners looking to raise capital, whether it's a new team that's spinning out from a larger investment firm, or it may be a team that's proven themselves and are looking to raise capital and they'd like to meet some new investors. On the due diligence side, there's a number of things to do. We make a lot of reference calls, talk to the CEOs of the companies that they've backed to verify the track record that they're presenting. The reason we do that, it's almost a triangle to see if they actually do have a story straight. These GPs are all smart, clever guys, mm-hmm. and they're going to tell us about all the great deals that they've done and their track record and all that, and then verifying that by speaking to the CEOs to confirm that these are the guys that actually did the deals, and mm-hmm. then we try to look at their files. Do the files track with what the CEO told us and what they told us? And if those three things match up, they probably do have a process, and it's probably okay.
When you say GP, you're talking about the general partners who are running the fund,
correct?
As opposed to the LPs, the limited partners, the people who are putting the capital
into
the fund.
Right. That's exactly right. And so, you know, one of the things we do is we tell the GPs, the general partners, that, you know, they're in the automobile industry, mm-hmm. they're selling cars. Every GP that comes in to see us is a smart, very clever guy, and these LPs can buy any car they want, you know, and they're probably going to do fine. Right. And so the
question is, why should they buy your car?
Correct. Our job is to try to identify that investor that is looking for a differentiated strategy, mm-hmm. Where it's additive to their portfolio, mm-hmm. To bring in another middle market buyout firm. Right now, everybody or a lot of growth equity and these software firms are doing very, very well. Most funds are doing well over 3x, right? And
right.
eyes glaze over almost with these limited partners to try to convince a limited partner to do more work. And you know what? I need you to substitute your existing manager for this new group. And I want you to take 6 months of extra work on your end to get the same return. That's a tough one. You know, I need to have a manager that's got a differentiated strategy that is additive to their portfolio, because that's what a lot of what a limited partner is thinking about. How can I improve, diversify my portfolio?
Sure. Makes a lot of sense. So hypothetically, you run these managers through your process. You check off a lot of boxes. Once the LPs put capital to work with these GPs, what are your responsibilities? Do they end at that point, or is it an ongoing relationship?
Generally, it's, you know, they're handed off to the GP. You know, our job is to manage the process from the initial contact with a prospective investor. I think they're a suspect before they're a prospect.
Right.
And so we go out to several thousand investors probably initially, to try to identify some prospects. And then once we have an initial meeting or initial video call, it's our job to help manage that process and move the investor through the different stages that they're going to be thinking about, you know, towards making a positive decision. And that could be a second meeting to meet other members of the management team, getting access to a data room to look at due diligence files, look at the portfolio performance, make some reference calls. Probably we'll do a visit on site to visit the offices. You know, mm-hmm. that was an issue during 2020 when people weren't traveling. You know, how does an institutional investor modify their investment policy procedures to make a commitment to a fund when they're unable to visit the office, if that's part of their policy? So a lot of those policies were amended or replaced with more reference calls and things like that.
So that raises an obvious question. During the lockdown, were you doing everything by Zoom? Were people going out and actually meeting the GPs in person to person?
The GPs were, of course, you know, they have one objective, which is to get funded.
Right.
And so they will go ready, willing, and able to go anywhere.
Right.
But a lot of the limited partners, especially the institutions, were generally in the first 6 months of the pandemic, you know, not really willing to meet.
Right.
Or they weren't going.
There's an age gap there, right? The GPs tend to be a little younger and hungrier, and the LPs are a little older and more seasoned. Is that a fair stereotype?
That's not bad. Yeah. I think the younger guys would, we had some meetings in Miami. We had some family offices. We had meetings outside.
Sure.
We did convert some in middle of the year. It was tough though. April, May.
Scary.
April, May was, everybody was on adrenaline, not really knowing what was going to happen.
Right.
But a lot of Zoom. It was very exhausting, but it's getting, people are traveling again and taking meetings. So
this raises another interesting question. Were there any lasting changes to the industry or how you do business because of what we learned during the pandemic? So lots of people still working from home. Lots of people are being more selective in their travel. Do I really have to go to LA or can I just make this a Zoom call? How has this impacted your business? How has the pandemic impacted the way you operate today?
I think it's making it a little bit more efficient. Now with annual meetings, there's always going to be a remote option. And so these limited partners were before in months of May, June, and September, October, November, most of the time, 50% of those, let's say 6 months, they would be out of the office, spending a day or 2 days traveling cross country to attend an annual meeting. Now they can watch it on Zoom for an hour and be much more efficient sitting at their desk. And I think that development, the fact that there is a remote option, has allowed general partners and capital raising firms like ourselves a better probability of getting to a prospective investor that's in the office where they're not wasting time traveling or wasting a half a week traveling to annual meetings.
So it's improved the efficiency. Yeah. Does that give everybody a wider net they can cast? Your geography isn't limited to your local city or even your local coast. You could pretty much go anywhere.
I think that has helped, but these limited partners are probably being bombarded by more and more emails incoming. And so it's still more valuable to have the one-on-one in person. But when that is not available, we definitely try for the video call.
And I'm curious as to these GPs, why come to a firm like yours as opposed to just hiring a team to raise the capital themselves?
To hire a team, train a team, it's a big expense. And
makes sense.
It's people.
And that's management cost and overhead and time and lack of expertise.
Correct.
So you mentioned people are looking for strategies that differentiate from everything else they have. What are some of the newer differentiated strategies or fund types that you're seeing more and more of that aren't as widely held as, let's say, commercial real estate or structured notes or things like that? What's the new thing these days?
Well, I think one thing we've seen the last couple of years is music royalties. Almost every month there's a new group targeting that. And, that emerged because these artists were unable to tour. And so that was a big source of their income, is to being able to tour. And now they're looking to sell some or all of their copyrights to cash out.
That's really interesting because the old days, people would tour to promote an album and they made the money from album sales. Now it's the opposite. They put out an album in order to tour. Once that shut down, they had some trouble. There's not a lot of money in streaming, is there, for most artists?
No, streaming saved the music business.
Saved the business, but how much of that falls to the artist?
The artists, I don't know the exact number, but I think every time a song is downloaded on iTunes, the songwriter gets, I think it's 11 or 12 cents.
Right.
But Spotify with the streaming, so the younger artists are doing well because the people listening to Spotify are not my parents.
Right.
And so the new classics are probably performing much better than Louis Armstrong
is
being downloaded or streamed. But I think we see music royalties. We're working with a group that not only does music, but they'll be coming out. They specialize in film and TV royalties.
Uh-huh.
And TV now, you have a lot of series that are picked up over and over.
So in other words, something goes to Netflix or HBO and
gets picked up. Those royalties behave in a similar fashion to a film library, the TV series, and so that's self-liquidating mezzanine debt. And so there's no capital markets event required for an exit, and it's generating a nice low to mid-teens net return to investors in a zero interest rate environment.
And so let's talk about that a little bit, because that's kind of fascinating. I know Dylan recently sold his catalog. Taylor Swift allowed streaming, which we hadn't previously. Pink Floyd. What does this look like when an artist says, here's a dozen albums I've created over 30 years. I want to monetize this. Tell us about that.
I think a song hits its steady state after about, I believe it's about 6 years. A good example, we worked with a music royalty group. We've raised 3 funds for them since 2010, so we've been at it for a while. But during the Olympics in London in 2012, Call Me Maybe was on the radio every 5 minutes. Now you never hear it.
Right.
And so it took about, a song hits its steady state after about 6 years, and they can monitor, they collect those revenues globally now. So whether it's played on the radio, whether it's played in a bar, at a skating rink, on, it's a set list at a concert by a musician, those artists receive those royalties every quarter. And you're basically just doing a cash flow analysis to see how it's going to play out. Mm-hmm. But you probably would be interested in, it's a little risky prior to 6 years because you don't know where it's going to, song is going to hit its steady state, so to speak.
So after 6 years, it's almost like the coupon on a bond, the yield on a bond. You have an idea, hey, at this point, it should yield X going forward. And not all songs are created equal. Not all artists are. Some are going to do 2X or 3X, but you don't know that until 6 years in.
Correct.
Huh.
Something like, yeah,
and,
more
and
or
so
less.
So you've done 3 funds that?
We've done 3 music funds with a group, and we've done 2 funds with another group that focuses on film and TV royalties. But their most recent fund, there wasn't a lot of new films being produced in 2020 and 2021. They dipped their toe into music. And so a little more diversified. I think there'll be some good interest in that next year when they come out with their successor fund.
How large can this space to get? There's only so many songs that get produced each year. It's only like 10 million songs, but not all of them make money. How much room is there in this little niche as a potential investment sector?
Music, it's, I don't know how big it will ultimately get to, but there's certainly long ways to go. And I think the film and TV, the TV is really taking off. When you see the number of series created, and they're picked up for multiple seasons, and film is,
similar.
Yeah, and once it's released theatrically, in the theaters in the U.S., then it goes to Europe, then it goes to pay per view on demand, and you're still seeing The Godfather every Christmas time. It's on 4 different channels.
Right. A classic Christmas movie.
Yeah.
Quite fascinating. Yeah.
Another interesting strategy that we've done 3 funds with a group focused on the sale leaseback.
Of
commercial real estate.
So I'm an old world company. I own all my real estate, all my buildings. And I'm tired of depreciating them over time. I sell the building to you and then do a 50-year lease?
Not quite 50 years, but yeah, that's exactly it. So you have the headquarters of a big pharmaceutical company, and they're looking to raise some cash, maybe not a pharmaceutical company, but some other business. It's a great non-bank source of financing. You can sell the asset and simultaneously re-lease it back for 15 to 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
you're protected against inflation. The manager is, because the rent increases are built in contractually, and you own the asset. So you're actually in a better position than the bondholders that own the same credit. And we've done three funds with this group. I think sale-leaseback, the investment banks haven't been promoting it because they probably, this is just me, a theory of mine, but the investment banks would rather convince the CFO of these corporates to do a bond offering or an equity offering because the fees are higher than suggesting, you know what, if I look at your balance sheet, you know, property, plant, and equipment is your largest line item. Why are you in the real estate business? Why don't you sell that, release it back, and reinvest back into the business? Another advantage for the company is to do it is by entering into a long-term lease, they're going to get a below-market rate,
right?
And the manager gets to buy the asset at a below-market price. And
interesting.
So we've worked with a group. It's been a little difficult raising capital for it because it's a hybrid. It's not quite credit because it's real estate-backed, and the credit guys don't understand corporate real estate, and the real estate guys don't understand credit. The real estate guys think the market's going to take is going to continue to go up, and they're not looking at the importance of the credit.
But that's the opportunity when nobody really understands. When the players in the space, it's adjacent, not dead center what they do, so they don't really get it.
Yeah, and so our job is as a capital raiser for that is to identify the prospective investor that might be a little more thoughtful or is looking for a product like this, which is generating, you know, 10-11% cash on cash.
But without a lot of volatility and fairly safely.
Yeah. And during the pandemic, they actually, this group collects their rent quarterly in advance versus monthly. And so they never had an issue all during the pandemic.
So let's talk a little bit about Focus Point. What's its specialty? Where do you really put your focus into Focus Point?
Sure. We raise capital for private funds and direct transactions. The typical fund strategies we are focused on are, I would, private equity managers in the mid-cap space from $250 million to, say, $2 billion in fund size. Growth equity managers, minority, or managers focused on control. Some software, but all throughout the tech sector, tech-enabled services, software, some hardware. And we've lately done a little bit in the venture capital world, and we do a lot in credit and income-related strategies.
Right.
And
so who hasn't done a little something in the venture capital world these days? It seems like there's just a ton of cash flowing into that, but you mentioned equity growth. Are those private, or are you talking about hedge funds that are in the markets?
These are private equity firms that are not seeking control of the businesses. So they're generally backing a management team, bootstrapped, and they're the first institutional money going into the business.
So is that
and the companies are growing, you know, 30-50% annually, and they need some equity capital to get to the next level. These growth equity managers provide that with their guidance, get them to 100 to 200 million in revenue, for say, and then they show up on the radar screen of the larger private equity firms that are looking to add on, you know, looking for a portfolio company to add on to an existing platform. And so it's almost a food chain that we're starting to see develop, which wasn't as apparent 3 to 5 years ago. But with the what's happening in the world of tech, it's increasing rapidly.
Quite interesting. Let's talk about land, sea investment. Sure. It almost sounds like land and sea, but it's land and the letter C. First, what does that name mean? And then we'll talk about what it does.
I've got a son named Lucas. I've got a son named Alex. I've got a wife named Nina. My name's David. And my last name's Conrad.
So there it is.
And that's the entity that owns the Focus Point Private Capital Group. And we, I'd say since 2016, 2017, we've been through the capital raising business. We started meeting some talented independent sponsors that were confident in their ability to get a transaction done where they, I was unable to convince them to do a fund. Mm-hmm. And so we would raise equity for them, and we started to participate in the promote structure with them. So Landsea owns a portfolio of ownership interests in some direct transactions. And on occasion, we participate in the promote structure with some first-time funds as part of our compensation.
So when you say you participate, you get a slice of the GP, is that right?
Of the GP economics, mm-hmm. correct.
Oh, not the control, just the economics, yeah. Just the cash flow from that.
The part of the percent of their carried interest for raising the equity. And mm-hmm. in some cases, we have invested in their GP. One thing we noticed is with independent sponsors, when they do have a direct transaction, the lenders want to see a fund that the GP commit is generally 2% minimum. Uh-huh. The lenders on a direct transaction for a sponsor who does not have a fund are asking for 10 to 20% for a GP commit. And they don't always have that lying around.
That's a lot of money.
And
right.
So being able to help them solve the GP capital problem helps improve our economic sharing.
Makes
for
sense.
For example.
And that sounds like those are potentially lucrative investments over
yeah.
time.
That's the object of the exercise, I guess, right?
As opposed to saying I want to put money into this fund that's going to yield 8 or 10%,
yeah.
when you're putting money into a direct investment, my assumption is those are
looking for
extraordinarily attractive opportunities.
Yeah, the investors are looking for a higher return. Mm-hmm. And we've done some things in the real estate related in the hospitality sector, focusing on the extended stay and the select service market with the former principal at a large investment bank. He had a $20 billion portfolio he oversaw at one point. He's been operating as an independent sponsor for 10 years.
Right.
And we've completed now 6 transactions with him. And we have, I guess, ownership in, north of 60 of those types of hotels. Mm-hmm. We recently identified a New York Stock Exchange listed insurance company to invest in 8 large shipping container vessels. That $170 million is now worth north of $500 million in only 9 months.
Wow.
As the container market is red hot right now.
This
insurance company was pretty savvy in recognizing that end of last year. And these are all end-of-life ships, so they go to scrap at the end of the charters that they're currently on. So mm-hmm. there's no exposure or risk of rechartering them at the end of these. And the investor at that insurance company, clever guy.
sounds like
actually
it.
Ex-colleague at Guggenheim.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Really, really interesting. So I mentioned land. Coincidental. It's really an anagram for you and your wife and your kids. But let's talk a little bit about triple net leases in real estate. Explain what that is and what's the investment opportunity there.
Yeah. If you look at most balance sheets of most corporates, property, plant, and equipment is the largest line item. And there's an opportunity there it's another non-bank source of financing. Mm-hmm. So a corporate looking to raise capital could unlock some of that get out of the real estate business, sell the asset, simultaneously release it back for a long period of time, 15 to 25 years, and have the use of those proceeds to reinvest in their business. Hmm. I think it hasn't been promoted a lot by the investment banking community, because I think the cynical side of me says they're making more money on a bond offering or issuing some more equity than suggesting a sale leaseback for an asset.
Uh-huh.
We came in contact, I guess, over 10 years ago with a very talented team from a guy who came out of a listed company called W.P. Carey. He built their international business, sold his share. He had a shareholding in that business, sold it back to W.P. Carey, and formed his new firm 10 years ago. We've raised 3 sets of funds for them, both in North America and Europe. And I believe that firm probably is pushing $7 or $8 billion in AUM. It's a great, it's another non-bank source of financing in a low interest rate environment.
Really interesting. And I'm curious about something. In the public markets, ESG has become really such a buzzword, environmental, social, and governance. Do you see anything like that on the private side, or is it much more blocking and tackling, less marketing and, you know, value-based investing?
I would say most institutional investors definitely have an allocation to ESG, and it's really increasing significantly.
On the private side.
On the private side, and that's a big part of their due diligence to go through. You know, there's ESG consultants now that ESG standards, definitely in Europe, is probably further ahead than the U.S. But it is, most of the managers have to be aware of that. But I think it's going to make their portfolio companies ultimately better because it's all focused on innovation. And you know, innovation is technology. And these companies will be better. And it's going to bring about better international standards that these companies have to operate under, and same with these GPs.
Quite fascinating. So let's talk about the state of private equity here in New York. It seems to be hot as a pistol. What do you see going on in the industry, and how has it changed over the past couple of years?
I think if I looked at our roster of general partners that we were working with back to, say, 2016, 2017, we probably only had one that had a technology element to it. Now everybody does. Even a distress for control manager that we're about to go to market with, with an assignment. And this is an individual that led the creditor group to gain control of Cirque du Soleil last year. Every strategy has to embrace technology to improve their businesses and take advantage of the innovation, and the competition is becoming increasingly fierce.
So these are tech components to non-technology companies. We're not necessarily talking about investing in semiconductors or software. These are more traditional businesses, but technology is a key part of them.
Yeah, and I'd say absolutely software to make them more efficient. You know, previously you may have had a financial services investor that was providing balance sheet capital. Now they're focused on payments. And
there's a
strategies.
Lot of software involved in
that. Yeah, correct. But you're seeing that in specialty industrial managers, healthcare managers, you know, obviously in venture capital, it's obvious. But any type of strategy, there's a technology element that they need to be thinking about it, because the competitive intensity with their competitors is only going to increase.
Really, really interesting. So I don't know if that's an opportunity or a strategy. I don't know how to think about that. What else are you seeing that's different than 5 years ago besides the impact of technology?
I think in this low interest rate environment, people are looking for yield and income. And how do they have a benchmark, and when bonds are returning zero, you know, they need to look at other income related or alternatives. You know, we've talked about sale leaseback, we've talked about music royalties, talked about film and TV royalties, asset-based lending in addition to just cash flow lending and leveraged loans. People are starting to see litigation finance strategies. You've seen some of those. Last week, I ran into two new income strategies I had never thought of. I don't know if they're scalable or we would do it, but one is liquor license lending in California. Apparently, in the state of California, there are no new liquor licenses. You have to buy an existing one, and 15% of the purchase price has to go in escrow while the due diligence is completed on the new buyer, and that's a 10% business. It's small. We've seen tax lien finance, you know, in different states, people buying the tax lien, and you know, people are a lot of creative people out there trying to come up with strategies that'll generate, you know, an attractive, you know, financial return.
Huh.
So we try to work our way through that, but you know, it's got to be scalable, and the management team has to be credible, and where there's a process in place where it's systematic and repeatable.
It might be a little early in the growth cycle of this, but are you hearing anything from clients about things like cryptocurrencies, blockchain, NFTs? That's the flavor of the month. What are you seeing on the private equity side there, if anything?
Yeah, absolutely. People are looking at that and allocating resource to it. And when you see the consultants also spending time and staffing up to do some research, it's probably here to stay. Some of the larger endowments have already made some allocations in the crypto and the digital currency world. So it's happening.
Really, really interesting. So previously we talked about Zoom calls and the efficiencies that took place during the pandemic lockdown when there was less travel. When COVID first was beginning, it looked like a distressed asset cycle was going to begin, but it seems to be the distressed assets cycle that never happened. How are you looking at those sort of opportunities in the first and second quarters of 2020?
We were thinking the same thing. We saw an individual that we know well who led the creditor group in March, April of 2020 to get control of Cirque du Soleil, right? If you think about that business, their sales stopped overnight.
Dead.
Globally.
Right.
Done. And there was a $1.2 billion of debt on that business, and
wow,
this guy created the company for $300 million. And it actually relaunched it just prior to Thanksgiving all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And but we thought the same thing. He's launched his fund. He's got four positions completed, you know, since I'd say 2Q, and he's probably up 1.6. If you think about distress, you've got a management team that's on a treadmill, and the private equity sponsor every quarter is telling them, make the interest payment. And every quarter, the tilt's going up and the speed is going up on that treadmill. And these distressed investors are just waiting for that amortization schedule to kick in. And at some point, that's going to happen and they're going to lose the company. And so I think there's a number of positions being built on these potential targets, but we haven't seen the carnage that everybody anticipated a year and a half ago.
It's really, really interesting. We haven't really talked about deal flow. You've been doing this long enough that you know so many people in the space. But what is it like? How do you find either the GPs you want to invest in or the specific deals that you might want to directly invest in?
Yeah, I have been doing it a long time, and some of my colleagues at Focus Point were also at Guggenheim from the beginning or early on. We all have a pretty good network of people. Our sourcing comes from some of the experienced investors that we've known a long time that may be at some large endowments or foundations that have a good relationship with a group, and maybe some of that team is spinning out to start something new. Some of our deal flow comes that way. Direct approach, where we go out, introduce ourselves, and a general partner may have been working with another capital raise partner for a number of years and might be thinking about, you know, maybe I should try somebody new and get introduced to some new investors that I may not have met that are not in the network of the existing capital raiser that I've been working with. So some of that, and we get emails all day long of new groups looking to raise capital. So I think it's a combination of all of it, some incoming, some proactive. Definitely, we're always speaking to limited partners. What groups do you like? Have you seen any strategies in this area? You know, if I look at the market, there's three components to it. I call it the trilogy. Mm-hmm. You've got the limited partners, who are the investors. You've got the general partners, and you have the intermediaries, which are the consultants and the gatekeepers. that work with a lot of the limited partners. And we're constantly hitting the limited partners, and they're meeting the sales force. They're seeing us at conferences. They're getting newsletters. They're reading about you in the press.
Mm-hmm.
And cold calls, whatever it may be. They're constantly getting introduced to products that we have. Same with the intermediaries and also with the general partners. We're trying to get them. But the intermediaries are going to influence the limited partners. The limited partners may tell the gatekeeper or the consultant, this looks mm-hmm. kind of interesting. I'd like you to do some work on it. So those three things are constantly moving, and we try to do it with rhythm and repetition, each one of these market participants and how we spend our time.
So we're used to the 2 and 20 fees with yeah. either VCs or hedge funds or private equity. Yeah. You guys are in a somewhat different niche. What does the fee structures yeah. look like relative to regular yeah. alternative investing?
Yeah, that's about right. So the rack rate for raising the capital for an established group is probably 2% mm-hmm. on committed capital. And then you're protected on the successor fund with, say, half fee on the 50% of the fee mm-hmm. that they paid last time up to their level, and then maybe something a little more on the incremental. Generally, an investor is underwriting to do two funds with a general partner, mm-hmm. and then they'll re-underwrite them seriously on fund three.
Mm-hmm.
There just won't be enough to come through by the time they're back in the market, especially mm-hmm. today when they're back every 18 months. On the credit side, the fees are a little less because they're charging a little less because sure. the returns are
much less.
Yeah. And so, you know, I'd say rule of thumb, if a credit strategy is returning, say, a net return of between 8% and 10%, the managers probably can't charge more than 1% on invested capital versus committed capital.
Right.
And maybe it's a 10% or 15% carried interest versus 20%. If the return is, say, 10% to 12% net, the credit manager might be able to get 1.5%, 1% to 1.5% on invested, you know, maybe a 15% carry, and then north of 12%. They're working their way closer to 2% and 20%.
Is there the same sort of fee pressure on the private side that we see in the public side? You know, you have yeah. Vanguard driving and others driving.
Race to the bottom.
Yeah,
yeah.
Which is great when you have scale, but everybody else, it definitely pressures them, and they don't have the same sort of economies of scale that BlackRock or right. Vanguard have. What are you seeing on the private side with that?
Definitely that on the fund of funds managers,
mm-hmm.
right? The fund of funds generally, you know, 10, 15 years ago could get away maybe with charging 1% and 15%.
On top of, right.
Yeah. And now on a, they're all moving into trying to make money with co-investments,
right?
And so that's where they're going to make that's their bread and butter. And they're almost giving away the primary investment.
Interesting.
The fees that they charge on that. Now, another interesting development where I think we'll see a lot of fee pressure are the private equity secondary managers.
Mm-hmm.
They've raised incredible amounts of money, tens of billions of dollars, from large LPs. They're paying a slight premium versus, you know, following the financial crisis, they were buying a lot of these limited partners were out of balance. When they rebalanced their portfolio, when the stock market declined, they were way over their targeted allocation mm-hmm. to private equity, so they had to sell. And these secondary managers did very well. They were buying those positions at steep discounts. Now they've continued to raise money, but they're probably paying a slight premium. And I think investing in a secondary manager when there's a lot of liquidity doesn't make a lot of sense to me.
Mm.
You know, I think investing in a secondary manager when there isn't liquidity, they're going to be buying in at steep discounts.
Huh.
And,
really?
And another dynamic is you're seeing these continuation funds being formed where general partners now are basically creating their own secondary funds themselves. So a GP will have their best asset, their taxpayers, and they'd
right.
rather just continue to compound. And so the
without having to pull it out and
without
and
having
pay
to
taxes
sell it,
on it, right?
Correct. And so they'll take their best asset, put it into a continuation vehicle, redeem out the LPs that want their capital back, bring right. in a new capital provider, and keep going.
Huh,
and so I think we'll see how that shakes out with some of these secondary managers that have raised a lot of capital.
So that raises a really interesting question. We seem to hear every couple of years a lot of chatter about doing away with the carried interest loophole. What do you think happens with that, and how significant is it?
I think it's going to stay where it is, and it is significant, though.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what motivates these, you know, very talented investors. And
especially on those secondary funds where you don't have to redeem and cash out. You can keep it running.
Yeah, and correct.
Really and, interesting. So we you mentioned liquidity. When I look at the venture side, there's just so much capital around. And we've certainly seen a similar growth spurt in the private equity side. What does that do when you see all this cash and capital coming into the space? In the old days, $2, $3, $4 billion, Wall Street was happy to participate in that space. Now it seems they're going further and further up the deal size scale, and what we used to think of as middle market continues to expand. What's the result of all of this capital rushing into the space?
I think in the mid-market, let's call it the lower mid-market, 250 to a billion
mm-hmm.
is probably, 250 is the lower end. You know, mid-cap would be, I'd say, between 500 and a billion and a half, or 500 and a billion fund size.
Mm-hmm.
There's more exit opportunities when you're have a company at that level than you have a $5 billion company, right? And so there's more options in terms of exit. You could potentially IPO it. It might fit for a SPAC. Or there's a lot of larger private equity firms that have raised, you know, significant amounts of capital, and they have platforms and they're looking to grow. And I think they're maybe some of them overpay for some of those assets. And
is that valuation issue ongoing? Is all that cash leading people to pay inflated values, even on the private equity side?
I think they're some of the larger firms are feeling the weight of the money,
mm-hmm.
and they have to get the money invested, and so
they can't turn it down, overpaying
a bit. Yeah, they might. You know, one anecdote for you is I know a tech investor, you know, probably sub $1 billion, a large, you know, $10+ billion firm was buying one of their portfolio companies. The smaller firm was going to roll their equity, roll 30 or 40% of their equity, you know, into the new company. The larger firm came to them and said, "You know what? If we pay you a little extra, can we just take all of it?" They said, yeah,
"Sure,
sold to you."
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
sold to you. One of my favorite lines of all time.
Yeah. So I think you're seeing some of that.
That's really interesting. All right, so let's jump to our favorite questions that we ask all of our guests. Starting with, what are you streaming these days? Give us your favorite Netflix or Amazon Prime. What's keeping you entertained?
My wife watches more of those than I do, but one that I definitely liked was The Serpent.
The Serpent?
The Serpent. Huh. That was, I think it was a BBC series about a French serial killer in the 70s in Southeast Asia.
Huh.
And
interesting.
It's amazing, and they finally caught him.
Right. Well, and, spoiler alert.
Yeah. But
interesting.
That one I liked. You know, I've seen a few series like that, but
interesting.
That one
stood out. Who are your early mentors who helped to shape your career?
Yeah, I would say it would be David Patterson, who ran HSBC's private equity business in China and Southeast Asia. He was based in Hong Kong, and that's who introduced me to private equity in 1992 when he showed up at our offices in New York with two $35 million funds that he had invested in Southeast Asia and looking to raise a fund in the U.S. with some U.S. investors.
Tell us about some of your favorite books. What are you reading right now?
What am I reading right now? A GP gave me Red Notice. I came out a couple of years ago, Bill Browder's book, where he had, I think he was the largest foreign investor in Russia at one point.
That was his first mistake. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's an amazing story once Vladimir Putin, you know, seemed to cut his deal with the oligarchs. And,
you know,
strong-willed guy.
Yeah,
and it's an amazing story. I think it would be a great movie. And I just recently read Elon Musk. I read a couple of the Rocket Billionaires, you know, about the...
Sure.
And then Elon, that led me to recently read Elon Musk's biography. Incredible what he's doing. You know, simultaneously trying to disrupt the three most complex industries in the world. Aerospace, financial services with PayPal, you know, when he got involved there, and automotive with Tesla simultaneously. So, he left South Africa, I think, you know, at 18. I think a distant relative of his mom, you know, there were some relatives in Canada, and he went for it.
It's an amazing story.
The rest is history, yeah.
Yeah, to say the least. What sort of advice would you give to a recent college grad who is interested in a career in private equity or capital raising?
I would say definitely get an internship where you can. We try to take in two or three interns every year, and that certainly helps them when they graduate, getting a position at an investment firm. Doesn't necessarily need to be a capital raising firm. I also think getting experience and credit, I would recommend that to anybody coming right out. I think that is a good foundation that can be very valuable.
Interesting. And our final question, what do you know about the world of private equity and capital raising and credit today that you wish you knew 30 years ago or so when you were first starting out?
I would say patience and perseverance, come up with a couple words. Raising capital, you can never stop. You just have to keep moving forward. Just like I ski race, I still do the Masters. And one of the coaches always tells me at the beginning of the gates, you know, for a practice run, keep moving forward. And I think just... raising cap, things are going to always happen. There'll be a key man event. Somebody will leave. A portfolio company will blow up. You know, could be some other. The Asian crisis, a pandemic can hit, but you can never stop. You just have to keep moving forward. And I would say you've got to be patient, and you just continually have to persevere.
Really, really good advice. How are your knees? Got to ask if you're ski racing still.
Knees are good. I had my reconstructive surgery from a soccer incident in 1990, and it's still there.
Held up.
It's still good. So far, so good.
Thank you, David, for being so generous with your time. We have been speaking with David Conrad. He is the co-founder and CEO at Focus Point Private Capital Group. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure and check out any of the previous 400 such discussions we've had over the past 7 years. You can find those at iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your favorite podcasts. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. You can sign up for my daily reading list of favorite articles each day at ritholtz.com. Follow me on Twitter at Ritholtz. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack team that helps put these conversations together each week. Mohamed Ramawi is my audio engineer. Atika Valbrun is our project manager. Paris Wald is my producer. Michael Batnick is my head of research. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.